As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Muddy Knees Media.
The heating's on, it's getting darker earlier and earlier, so why not cheer yourself up this November with a subscription to The Athletic for just £1 a week. For only 100 of your English pence every 7 days, you'll get unrivaled analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, plus a breaking news service and ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts. Sign up today at theathletic.com/totally.
Totally Football Show European Edition today. Sane old story in Der Klassiker as Leroy helps Bayern beat Dortmund. There's COVID chaos in Syria. Real Madrid get burnt by Soler. And in France, PSG make light of their absentees with Moyes keen to show he can cut it at the sort of elite level. This is the Totally Football Show European Edition in association with Paddy Power. Welcome along, listener. Matt Davis Adams filling in for Jimbo this week. Other than that underwhelming substitution, we're at full strength. Rafael Honigstein is here. Hi, Rafa.
Hi, Matt.
Mi amigo de mucho tiempo, Alvaro Romeo, is on board. Hola, Alvaro.
Hola, Matt. How are you?
Very well, thank you. All the better for talking to you. It wouldn't be a European pub without James Horncastle. Ciao, Bella.
Bello, not Bella.
Bella. Oh, I've got long hair, but still.
Yeah. Going in two-footed early on Jules with that Moise Kean comment there, Matt.
Yeah. I thought I'd try and sneak it in there, but obviously I haven't got away with it. Last but not least, the ever-formidable Julien Laurent. Hi, Jules.
Bonjour.
To kick us off, let's have a moment of the week from each of you, please. Jules, as we were with you, you can go first.
Can I pick someone from the second division? Geoffroy Couffaut, who's the right back at Valenciennes, who scored four goals. Four goals for a right back, none of them on penalties in the game at the weekend. I thought it was just fantastic. That's why I thought I would mention him. That's it.
Wow. If Matt thinks Moise Kean scoring goals for PSG is elite level sort of, imagine what he thinks of Ligue 2.
I spent a lot of time commentating on Ligue 2 and yeah, not great days, I've got to be honest. It's a bit kind of Alan Turing, 0-1, 0-1, 1-0, 0-0, 0-0. Lonely Friday night.
There's some great games in France this week. 4-4, it was the Derby de Rhône.
Yeah, I just thought I'd pick something a bit different, but I mean, how long do we have?
I like it. I like it, Jules. It's perfect. You've set the bar high for Rafa. And Rafa, I'm not sure you can match that sensational David Alaba story you brought us last week, but give it a go.
Oh,
hint of sarcasm. Valentino Lazaro with a scorpion kick, homage to Ibra. Ultimately futile because Gladbach lost, but what a goal.
Yeah, it was pretty spectacular. How about you, Alvaro? What stood out for you in La Liga?
Well, a hat-trick is always news. A hat-trick from the penalty spot is even more news. And a hat-trick from the penalty spot against Real Madrid, which is what Carlos Soler managed to get, it's the most newsworthy thing that I can recall and recollect from La Liga this weekend.
Yeah, hot stuff. How about you, James?
Well, I think the 6 draws in 10 games, the 3 nil-nils that we had in Serie A, that's a good place to start. But no, I think... All eyes are very much on Lazio, not only at the weekend, but for the last fortnight, really. And their results, not their results on the pitch, but off it, regarding COVID-19. So I'm sure we'll get to that and explore it in a bit more detail in a bit.
Excellent. Well, there were some sensational goals scored all around Europe, not least in the Bundesliga. That's our first stopping point. We'll arrive there next.
The Totally Football Show European Edition's Moment of the Weekend, brought to you by Paddy Power. Defences may be looking shaky at the moment, but Paddy's offers are rock solid. If one leg of your 4-plus fold ACCA lets you down, get a free bet. Max free bet £10, minimum odds 1 to 5 per leg. Online exclusive, no shop bets. T's and C's apply. 18+, begambleaware.org.
Lewandowski nicht, Alaba macht! Und er macht Klasse! 1-1! Kommt bei Lewandowski! Und 1-2! Etzani! Etzani! 1-3!
So, Rafa, just like in the Super Cup back in September, Bayern Munich beat Borussia Dortmund by 3-2. This time they did it after coming from a goal down. Were they worthy winners?
They were. They played pretty well. They were tested and pushed quite severely by this Dortmund side. But Dortmund counting themselves a little bit unlucky because they actually had better chances than Bayern, outscoring Bayern in the XG. That's something that's only happened once before in the Hansi Flick era, when they lost that wild Hoffenheim game 4-1 earlier this season. Goes to show just how good Dortmund were, really. Bayern, of course, have the muscle, they have the individual quality. They could have also scored at least two more goals. So I think a draw might have been the right result. But I guess Dortmund played well enough to not just feel as if sort of they were Bayern's equal on the day, but also to give everyone else hope. That was certainly the big takeaway in all the big German media publications, saying that this kind of is encouraging. The Bundesliga is not there yet. Bayern will struggle to keep the intensity. Dortmund nearly punished them. And high Liga, as they say in Spain. So a really, really good game. And maybe an outcome that is as good as it is for Bayern, it's also good news for the rest of the league in a strange way, even though Bayern won.
You wrote a piece for The Athletic about Robin Lewandowski, and primarily Rafa, which came out on Saturday, obviously former Dortmund player who scored here, 259 goals in 300 games for him, and he's been dedicating goals to the great Gerd Müller, who is still obviously a long way behind in the all-time goal-scoring charts for Bayern.
Yeah, Gerd Müller will probably never be caught, but Lewandowski is giving it a go. I mean, his dependability is just amazing. And I considered the other day that, you know, when he moved over to Bayern in 2014, it kind of cemented Bayern's hegemony in the Bundesliga, at least, to get a goal scorer of this magnitude over from Dortmund and effectively stealing him from under the noses of some big European clubs who are also interested, is kind of the backbone of their rise back to European superpower status. Of course, along with the likes of Robin and Ribéry, but to have him up front and scoring goals almost irrespective of who the coach is, what the formation is, what the system is, has Bayern made almost too big to fail. But, you know, Joshua Kimmich injured himself in an attempt to foul Erling Haaland. He'll be out until January. Bayern are already out with Alphonso Davies. They missed Benjamin Pavard. So things are getting to the point where their high energy game is beginning to creak a little bit under the pressures of not being able to rotate a lot and a general lack of freshness, which of course will only be exacerbated by a lack of rotation in the next couple of months. So I think there is enough to suggest that Bayern can be get at, perhaps for one or two teams playing on the counter-attack. The question is, can you stop them scoring at the other end? Because when you can bring on Leroy Sané, as you alluded to in your intro, as a super sub, it's pretty devastating and demoralizing for the opposition. And we saw even against Salzburg in midweek, you know, Salzburg created tons of chances, probably did enough to get at least a point out of the game. But then with 20 minutes to go, Bayern make a few substitutions and score 4 more goals. So it's pretty difficult to keep them down, even when they're not quite at their best at the moment.
Raf, switching the attention back to Dortmund for one moment. Yeah, we've all got used to Erling Haaland scoring at the same rate that he has done in the Champions League, for example, where he's scoring more than a goal a game. But in this game, although he did get on the score sheet, I was slightly surprised by the positions he either got himself in, either for a shot or for that final ball. It just didn't happen for him.
I agree. He missed a few.
In the game. I think it's maybe the kind of high bar that he's really set for himself. But I thought he could have had a hat-trick in this game quite easily.
I agree.
Yeah, he could have had a hat-trick, although the one shot he dragged wide, I think VAR would have intervened if it had gone in. He looked offside in the first half, it was, yeah. But yeah, that was one of the points that Mats Hummels made. You know, we were a little bit unlucky with the way that Bayern took their chances, three deflections, and we were a little bit sloppy, maybe inexperienced when it comes to converting our chances. And I don't think it was an accusation. I think it was just, an honest appraisal of Haaland being an unbelievable player, but not quite a Lewandowski. I mean, he still will miss chances. I think he still will make mistakes. Dortmund did well enough to put him in decent positions, I thought, with Sancho and Reyna providing some amazing passes. And of course, the pass of the day was the one that led to the goal from Rafa Guerrero, who was really sensational for Dortmund. So I think it's probably a case of more looking at what he's good at already rather than pointing at flaws of his game. But yes, your wider point is right, James. You almost kind of expect Haaland to score more goals and do better. And maybe on another day he punishes Bayern and we have at least a draw for Dortmund.
So after that result, Bayern top, Dortmund in third. In between them, Leipzig, who beat Freiburg by 3-0. No Champions League hangover for them this time, albeit I'm guessing this is a game that they were almost expecting to win.
It's the sort of game that they have to win if they want to keep going, if they want to put serious pressure on the top two in Bayern and Dortmund. They've been consistent, by and large, in the league. I think there are signs that they're getting to grips with juggling, players and rotating just enough to have freshness for both competitions. PSG, you'd expect them to beat them. They're all over the place. But then there's Freiburg, which is a much more difficult team to play against now. I jest, of course. But no, I think the fact that we hardly talk about them is just a sign of their maturity. We expect them to win. We expect them to be up there. And the bigger news is when some of the likes of Leverkusen suddenly had put a good run together, even on Union Berlin in fifth spot. Because Leipzig, I think by now, whether you like it or not, there are plenty of people, of course, don't, for reasons that we have mentioned many times on the pod, they have put themselves in that third spot. And then it's everyone else trying to get that fourth one for the Champions League.
What is behind that Union Berlin run to fifth, Raf? Because that is a surprise. This is only their second season back in the Bundesliga.
It is surprising, James. They have been playing football as well. I mean, their first season was built on being quite Pomo style. Lots of long balls and then going for the second ball, the layoff. It was quite direct, but very effective now. There's actually combination play, there's movement, and there's Max Kruse, of course. I mean, he's made a big difference. Max Kruse is the kind of guy who, playing as a second striker, makes everyone look good. We saw that at Bremen a couple of years ago when he left, they completely collapsed. We see it now with Union Berlin. He had three assists against Bielefeld. He scored a penalty in that 5-0 win. And he's just that guy who runs the show. He's always available, he always plays the right pass, he has a bit of an arrogance, a bit of a nasty streak, everything that you really want from such a player, the experience. And it'd be a little bit reductive to just point the finger at him, but certainly he's given Union Berlin a different dimension. Now the big question is, and we talked about this in our Starkas pod, what will Champions League games look like at Alte Försterei next season? they might have a problem fitting the VIP tents into the little grove, the woods surrounding the stadium. It's another really good story. And just goes to show, I think, that the league, despite a lot of misgivings when Bayern won it again last year, actually continues to provide good storylines. And those who follow German football closely, of course, first and foremost, the people in Germany, are beginning to, I don't want to say fall in love with the league again, because there's still a diminished love affair at the moment, but at least find that there is, you know, still a lot of intrigue and surprise, and maybe not a foregone conclusion in the title race either.
Yeah, and another team doing really well at a Bayer Leverkusen. Sounded like a fun game at the Bayer Arena, where they beat Gladbach by 4-3. And Leverkusen, 4 goals in each of their last 3 games in all competitions, 31 in 11 games all told so far this term. What's the limit of their ambition? Is it Champions League qualification would be about as much as they can hope for, or can they look a little bit higher than that even?
Well, I mean, realistically, they could, of course, try and win the Europa League. I think they have an outside chance. Perhaps didn't quite do themselves justice last year when they were knocked out by Inter quite comfortably. In the league, it's going to be difficult. I think they have at least 3 teams ahead of them that we mentioned. I think Gladbach also slightly more durable, even though they lost that game. And for them, you know, if you want to talk about Champions League sort of hangover, that was the kind of game where after this fantastic run, you know, beating Shakhtar, holding Inter and Real Madrid to draws, which 2 games they also might have won, it was probably the inevitable slight step back that you expect from a team like that. So for Leverkusen, I think, yeah, fourth is really for them winning. And then there's the cup, of course, where they could go far as well. But there's always going to be a limit to their ambition simply because of the size of the club and the constant pressure on the best players to move on. We saw that with Kai Havertz, and if Leon Bailey and Lucas Alario keep playing as well as they did in this game, then, you know, maybe in January, but certainly in the summer, again, bigger clubs will come in for them. So it's always going to be slightly more difficult for them to hold on to their best players as it is now for Dortmund and certainly for Bayern.
Last game I want to touch on from the Bundesliga this weekend was the 2-2 between the bottom two, Mainz and Schalke, sharing the points. 23 league games without a win for Schalke. Now, the world was at a very different place when they last won a Bundesliga game back in January. Are they trying to put a positive spin on this by saying that they're 3 unbeaten now?
They don't do that, but they have noted in this particular game that they came back twice from a goal down and actually were much the better side. Now, this is against probably the worst team in the league, so as consolations go, it doesn't really do a lot for them, having been the better side against the worst team in the Bundesliga. But, you know, one or two signs that Manuel Baum, the new coach, is having a bit of an impact. Attacking-wise, the game looked a lot more dynamic. They created chances. They really outshot Mainz and could have had a better result. So I think the Tasmania Berlin record of 31 games without a win is still in danger by the Schalke team, but I think they might be okay. Just noteworthy, perhaps, which was quite unusual to see Sky Germany, the rights holders, refer to the game as El Trasico, which I thought was an interesting way to put it. Just imagine Sky sort of doing the same here in the UK when it's, I don't know, West Brom against Fulham. I'm not sure that the two clubs and the two sets of supporters would have been very happy.
Yeah, it gives a whole new meaning to Car Crash TV. Right, you might not be able to travel around Europe much just now, but you can do it metaphorically with us, which is, if not the next best thing, at least a thing. We're off to Italy next. Do join us.
Don't just ride the index. Seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, take out a 30-day trial to see their unrivaled coverage of each and every Premier League club by heading to theathletic.com/totally.
James, got to be easier for you admin-wise this week, being the only person with that name on the show. Before we get specific on the Serie A action this weekend, it being 2020 and all, we've got to talk a bit of COVID. Looks as though it's going to have a big effect on those Italian-based players who were slated to link up with their national teams this week. Players from Fiorentina, Sassuolo, Genoa, Roma, Lazio and Inter banned from travelling by local health authorities. What's the word from the clubs and the players been in response to this?
Well, on the one hand, coaches are happy because they get to keep large swathes of their players for the international break. It means that they get them to rest and recuperate. They might have some time to actually do some training, which you know, a lot of managers have been saying is impossible of late. On the other, clubs are unhappy in other regions, for example, in Lombardy, in Milan, because at this moment in time, the likes of Inter and Milan, there is no such prohibition stopping them from stopping their players responding to call-ups to their national team. So, yeah, the chief executive of Inter yesterday, Beppe Marotta, come out and basically say, look, this is going to affect the competitive balance of the league. You know, there's no uniformity. Yeah, just to give you some insight into the decisions here, the health authorities in Tuscany basically stopped players from Fiorentina joining up with their national teams after Jose Callejon tested positive for COVID-19. The same happened in Rome, in the Lazio region, when Edin Dzeko tested positive. So players at Roma and also the two teams that they played against over the last week have been told that they must stay back as well to stop the contagion, stop transmission, which I think was already revealed to be quite a big issue during the last international break. Particularly for a team like Inter, who lost Milan Skriniar, one of their best centre-backs. He tested positive for COVID whilst in Slovakia with his national team and wasn't able to come back until he'd tested negative and isolated there. So he was away for more or less 3 weeks. But this lack of uniformity, it just adds to this sense that there's a very confused situation there. And to be honest, I mean, it's not entirely surprising given what's happened with Lazio over the last fortnight, which puts the whole system really in some sort of jeopardy, because it's been front page news, at least on the sports papers, since Thursday, and has taken some credibility away from Serie A's ability to deal in this environment, to negotiate this environment in a way that is COVID safe.
Well, let's talk about Lazio then. So a whole host of players missing against Bruges, then back for the win at Torino, and then absent again for the trip to Zenit. There's talk they could even face relegation from Serie A as a result of this. Is that likely? And President Claudio Letito maybe not helping things with his response, which was not particularly measured.
No, Letito's one of the more aggressive owners in Serie A. He's usually the guy who's in charge of everybody outside of the big six, if you want to use a Premier League comparison. He's the chief whip of that group. But you mentioned the fact that there's this discrepancy between, you know, players testing negative for games in Serie A and players testing positive for games in the Champions League. Yeah, that's because the tests are done by two separate labs. And again, this whole situation has really kind of exposed some of the loopholes, the shortcomings of Serie A's protocol. In that, for example, with the Champions League, every club participating in that competition undergoes a round of tests with the same lab, a SIN lab. Whereas in Serie A, more or less every club can pick and choose which lab they go and get their testing done from. Lazio rather curiously have gone with this lab in Avellino, so it's not even in their region. It's in Campania rather than Lazio, and this lab has repeatedly returned negative tests for players who have tested positive in the round of UEFA tests, and that has aroused some suspicion. It's drawn scrutiny. So, for example, you had Lazio's training ground and that lab in Avellino were raided by the authorities over the weekend to gather as much evidence as they can, as an investigation has been launched. Lazio, in the meantime, after getting a first opinion, which is the lab in Avellino, a second opinion, which is the lab in UEFA, decided to seek a third opinion, which was a separate lab in Rome. And the lab in Rome returned results like UEFA's lab, which the players who tested positive before the Bruges and Zenit games tested positive for the most part again. And those players, therefore, should not have played against Torino. They should have isolated. They shouldn't have trained. In some circumstances, they did train, you know, which again raises the question about exposing teammates to contagion, exposing opponents to contagion. You know, the Torino game, for example, Immobile plays and scores in what turns out to be a 4-3 win. He shouldn't necessarily have been available for that game. And if, for example, there was an outbreak at Lazio with lots of players who test positive, and if one of their opponents were to have an outbreak as well, that might lead to a fixture being unfulfilled, adding to, you know, more fixture congestion and compromise the ability to finish the season. So it is a very serious situation, which, you know, they are hoping to get to the bottom of over the course of this international break.
In terms of on the pitch, 1-1 between Lazio and Juventus, Felipe Caicedo with a 95th minute equaliser means three of Andrea Pirlo's four away games as a Serie A manager have ended in a draw. Was a point apiece about fair, did you think?
Well, I mean, looking at the XG, Juventus created the better chances. Ronaldo, for example, hit the post as well. It was an interesting game because Juventus showed a different side to themselves compared with what we've seen from Pirlo up until now, which is to be quite cavalier, press high, and often teams have been able to play through that press and expose their back three or back four, depending what situation they find themselves in. In this, they decided to sit back, essentially, and hit Lazio on the counter-attack, and they did that very well for an hour or so. They limited Lazio to very few chances until the final 10 minutes. And then Ronaldo went off, Morata went off, Kulusevski went off. And the players who can really stretch Lazio, who could counter and push the team up the pitch, were no longer there. And they conceded in the 95th minute. So that most Juventus of results, a 1-0 win, eluded them. And, you know, Paulo Dybala got a lot of criticism after the game, more on social media than from his manager, which was, you know, I mean, he kind of casually miscontrols the ball as Juventus looked to play out. It goes out from a throw-in, and from that throw-in, Lazio score an equaliser against a set defence, you know, a defence that should do better in that situation. But the story goes to Felipe Caicedo, who, you know, yet again scores a very late goal to get Lazio points. You know, he did it last weekend in the 4-3 stoppage time win against Torino. He did it against Zenit in the 82nd minute, and he did it again in this game in the 94th minute. And, you know, for a team that is going through, you know, is training and working in a really weird environment at the moment, given, you know, all the scandal around this testing program, for Inzaghi to get these results with a very limited, depleted team, I think is again just testament to what a good manager he is.
So Juventus may be disappointed with a draw. Milan, possibly not, given the circumstances of their 2-2 against Verona. 2-0 down inside 20 minutes, rescuing a point, preserving their unbeaten run thanks to that man's Zlatan again, 93rd minute equaliser for him this weekend. Means they're 2 points clear at the top going into the international break. But off the back of that defeat against Lille in the Europa League as well, just a couple of slightly wobbly results as we go into this fortnightly pause. Will they be concerned about it?
I think they'll be glad just to have got into the international break with their unbeaten record, at least in the league, still intact. I mean, it is quite amazing. This is the second longest unbeaten run that Milan have been on since, you know, the Invincibles back under Fabio Capello. To be honest, I was really impressed with Lille on Thursday night. I thought they were excellent, tactically superior to Milan. Renato Sanchez was outstanding in that game. And, you know, I think we tend to see that teams that go through the preliminary rounds of the Europa League, and Milan played three of them against Shamrock Rovers, Rio Ave, Bodo Glimt, that fixture congestion does tend to catch up with teams. And I think it has caught up with Milan to an extent. So I think this international break will be welcome. Although, you know, as we were talking about earlier, Milan are not in a region which has imposed restrictions on players joining up with their national team. So how much of a rest they'll get remains to be seen. Although Zlatan, despite posting a photo of him wearing a Sweden shirt the other day, is not coming out of retirement to play for Sweden.
Not yet, anyway. Jules, would you go along with James that Europa League game was more about Lille's quality than Milan being subpar?
Yeah, I thought they were really good. I thought it was a really good game. I think Lille surprised themselves, to be fair, because they were so good for a team, for example, who were 2-0 down against Celtic a week before that. But they played so well, Renato Sanchez. I mean, I felt for Tonali, who's clearly slowing getting into that team and the rhythm, and Renato just picked him apart every single time he touched the ball. Yazici was great. I thought Botman at the back was great as well. It was really good. And then Lille go and lose 3-2. I Brest to show the strength of this French league and French football. You know, they go and can't beat Brest at the weekend.
3-0 down.
3-0 down at half time, or like after 40 minutes. Yeah,
I was so impressed by Lille. I was like, I'm going to go look out for their fixture this weekend. And I was like, what? 3-0 down.
Don't do that. Just don't do that.
Back to Serie A, Genoa 1, Roma 3. Alexander Davison has tweeted at the Totally Show to ask, are Roma realistic title challengers? I suspect you'd rather like them to be, James.
Well, look, I think as with Spain and the Premier League at the moment, Serie A feels really open. I think we're no closer to knowing who is a genuine title contender than we were at the eve of the season. Although, you know, maybe even then we'd look at Inter on paper and the players that they'd signed and would be proclaiming Inter the favourite to kind of take the crown off Juventus. But Roma have been really impressive. I mean, they're unbeaten, unless you count the game against Verona, which was a draw, but then the Sporting Tribunal awarded a win to Verona because there was a clerical error when Roma named their squad and they ended up fielding an ineligible player. Not the best of starts for the new owners at Roma, but since then they've really kicked on, and Mkhitaryan has been brilliant. You know, looks to be back to his Bundesliga best. The player that we saw at Borussia Dortmund, who, you know, justified that move to Manchester United. You know, someone who had to carry the attack on his shoulders in some respects in this game because Dzeko was out after he tested positive for COVID-19. They have signed Borja Mayoral, who scored his first goals for the club against Cluj on Thursday. But for Mkhitaryan to get a hat-trick and, you know, in all manner of statistics, goals, assists, you know, XG, I mean, Mkhitaryan is having a blinding season, as is Pedro, who's signed. So, I mean, watching Roma to some extent is a little bit like catching Premier League years 2012-13. But it's good, and I think their defence is excellent as well. They've got three young centre-backs who are all really good. Rodri Banez, Marash Kumbula, and also Gianluca Mancini. And then Smaldini. Smaldini made a little bit of a mistake in the Genoa game, but ultimately it didn't cost them. But I think in terms of getting back into the Champions League for the first time in 2 years, then it looks good for Roma right now.
Alvaro, James mentioned Borja Mayoral there. He's come through the Real Madrid youth system. What can you tell us about him that Roma fans might enjoy watching this season?
Yeah, I think that he improved a lot last season playing for Levante, because a player that age needs to play. I mean, there are so many cases of promising guys who stay at Real Madrid 1 or 2 years more than they should, and then by the time they want to catch up with the lost time, it's too late for them, and we have seen that. But with Mayoral, last season at Levante, he learned a lot under Paco. I believe that Paco is a manager who does very well the micromanagement as well, so if Mayoral had any confidence issues, I'm sure that Paco would have lifted his confidence as well. And yeah, he's a player who can play as a number 9, and he does very well in that position, but I believe that also he's pretty good when he drops to the sides, and he holds the ball as well. So it's good news for Spanish football too, in all fairness, because at the minute Spain doesn't have many good number nines. I mean, Álvaro Morata is probably the most famous one, but he is inconsistent. Paco Alcácer, he is recovering his form at Villarreal. And then Gerard Moreno, he has been good, but none of them are great. So having a person like or a player like Borja Mayoral who can actually become a candidate to play for the Spanish national team, maybe not now, but in a year time, it's great news for us.
So Mayoral could be important for Roma going forward. Mkhitaryan certainly looks like he's going to be. We ought to end this section by firing up the Mkhitaryan song.
Mkhitaryan, arriva dall'Armeno che fa come entreno e Mkhitaryan.
Grande.
Ho trovato la pasta certino lo spasta e Mkhitaryan. È venuto da Londra la Lazio a fondo e Mkhitaryan.
A grande.
Mkhitaryan.
Okay, I mean, if you've gone to all that trouble to produce a track, you think you might want to get somebody with a little bit of tonality to sing it. But anyway, we can't top that, so let's say goodbye to Serie A for now and prepare. And grand bonjour pour Ligue 1.
A grande!
At Paddy Power, we know competition for the remote control can be fierce at the weekends. So, in order to give the non-football-loving occupants of your house something to do, here are some of our top suggestions. Go for a walk. Walk the dog. Walk to the shops. Go cycling. Cycle the dog. Recycle the dog. Just go! All very good options, we say. And that's not the only one. If one leg of your 4+-fold acca lets you down, get a free bet on all football leagues and all markets. Paddy Power. Max free bet £10, min odds 1 to 5 on each leg, online exclusive, exclude shop bets, T's and C's apply, 18+, begambleaware.org.
The Totally Football Shows and The Athletic are delighted to be supporting Football Aid for the months of October and November. Bid now at footballaid.com to get your hands on some incredible football memorabilia, including signed shirts from Steven Gerrard, Gianluca Vialli, Gareth Bale and even Peter Crouch's boots. Find out more, get bidding and support the cause at footballaid.com.
France, you'll never believe this. PSG enjoyed a routine home win this weekend, 3-0 against Rennes. Tough this, Jules, for Rennes, really, because they'd had that pretty horrendous experience at Stamford Bridge just a few days before, where they played for the entire second half with 10 men. Not ideal preparation to go into such a big game for them.
No, you're right. They were not happy at all by the red card. I mean, German referees, that's what happened when, you know, you let German referees referee games. Especially at Stamford Bridge, where clearly the lobbying against the referee and, you know, big club against small club and all of that, the president of Rennes called it a scandal. I don't think no one cared, really. I mean, he could have spoken for a long time, but it was just Chelsea won, and then they had to go to Paris, as you said, on Saturday night. A PSG team decimated with injuries, which, by the way, lost four more players on the night. Kerrer, Gay, I mean, Moise Kean a little bit as well, and Florenzi. So it's just not easy. I mean, PSG have a whole 11 of players out, pretty much. So it was bad, but they won. Di Maria was good. That's the most important, because, as we said, Lille lost as well. So now the gap at the top is even bigger. But there's something, I just don't think everybody gets injured players this season. But with PSG, there's something else. I don't know. There must be something else, whether it's Tuchel's, it can't be even Tuchel's training sessions, because there's no training sessions. All they do is recover, have light training to prepare for the next game, play, recover, light training. So I don't know why they're hit more than others, but they're certainly by far in the big clubs in Europe, the ones that have been hit the most by injuries.
Raf, last week, Jules spoke about the relationship or lack thereof between Leonardo and Thomas Tuchel. You're somebody who knows quite a lot about the inner workings of football clubs. I wonder if that breakdown of a relationship could be a legitimate excuse for players to use as to why they're maybe not firing on all cylinders in PSG's case, or is that not something that would filter down to the training ground?
I think players pick up on a bad atmosphere. If two leading figures inside a club are at war, it doesn't make for a happy dressing room, especially if perhaps some of the players are getting the backing of the coach and some players are getting the backing of the sporting director. So, you know, it does filter through, or it can filter through into the team dynamics. But I guess in a wider sense, players, once they start playing, I don't think that they really particularly care what's going on above them, effectively. So I'm sure it doesn't help. Does it explain some of the underwhelming performances? I'm not sure, but I'm sure what I am sure of is that, and I'm pretty certain that Jules will agree, it's not the sort of thing that helps you when there isn't harmony at all levels in the club.
Let's move on to Lyon against Saint-Étienne. Jules, I know you've got a lot to say about this. The Rouen derby secured by the Zimbabwean Tino Kadewere coming off the bench to get both goals. Seven games unbeaten now for Lyon in Ligue 1.
Yeah, 121st derby du Rhône. Without fans, it's obviously like every derby or every game, it was a bit different, but still a very, very eventful night. I mean, Saint-Étienne, who under Claude Puel hadn't won, I think lost their last five before Sunday night, really arriving there not in a good run. Lyon a bit better, although there's still a lot of debate over Rudy Garcia, the way he plays, his team selections and things like that. We saw Ryan Cherki, for example, they won the kid, not being happy at all by the fact that he doesn't play anymore. You've got others like Kakré or Bruno Guimaraes feeling a bit the same. And then when Saint-Étienne took the lead earlier on and played really well, to be fair to them, in the first half, Lyon was so bad. They were so dreadful that you think, okay, if they lose now, this could go crazy. And then in the second half, some of the changes that Garcia made, including Kadewere, as you said, who was playing for Le Havre last season. He was the top goal scorer in the second division. Joined Lyon in January, but stayed on loan there, then lost his brother during the summer. Had really tough times. And now he's sort of like an impact sub, sometimes starts, sometimes doesn't, but did really well. He said on French television on Sunday morning, I had a dream last night that I scored two goals in the derby. And then he came on, scored two goals to win it 2-1. And then in the last minute of the game, Saint-Étienne have a penalty to make it 2-2. And stop their rotten series, you know, everything that had happened the last few weeks, forget it. And then Bouanga misses the pen. So it was a crazy game. Good for Lyon and Rudy Garcia, who buys him some time. And for Claude Puel and Saint-Étienne, who are on a very young project, young in terms of, you know, early project, but also young in terms of the age of the players in that team is crazy. They're still not there yet. And I think they could have more problems going forward. But for Lyon, it's another win in the derby and it's a good one for them before the international break.
Okay, so that was a crazy game. What about the second half between Lens and Rams? 1-0 at halftime, and then try and talk us through what happened in the second 45 if you can.
Yeah, and I mean, just a bit of background, because Lens, because of COVID, had two games postponed. So they hadn't played for 3 weeks. So you thought, okay, they're going to play, and they're a team that press high with a lot of energy. They run a lot, and you think they would be dead in the last 30 minutes. You know, they're not going to be able to cope because they haven't played for 3 weeks. And they came back to 2-2 with 15 minutes to go. Then they went back to 4-2 down with just 9 minutes to go, and say, okay, this is it. You know, they just can't come back now. And then they scored two goals in 90th and 91st minute to come back to 4-4. And then they have a penalty in the 95th minute. And you just think like, oh, come on. And then VAR cancels the pen, which is a shame. But in fairness, that was the right call. But it was just that one of the most incredible game between Lens and Reims. And like James said at the beginning, we've had some crazy game. Not as much as the Strasbourg-Marseille one on Friday night, which I think was the best publicity ever for Ligue 1 French football.
So that finished 1-0 to Marseille. Happier times for AVB there. How did the media in France react to his post-match comments after the defeat in Porto? Was it a shitstorm?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously they got battered in Porto, and then they win that game away at Strasbourg, where for the first time since Opta working in France, for the first time a team with just one shot, that's just one shot in the whole of 90 minutes, wins a football match. That's it. And that was them. It was Sanson, who scored a great goal, to be fair to him. And Dimitri Payet was involved, and both came off the bench. So we said to, you know, AVB at the end, that was not pretty. And then he went mad, absolutely mad. What do you expect? Who do you think you are? You know, we won. It's a tough place here to come. But, you know, his team was crap. But yet they won. He was right, in fairness, somehow. Clearly was not good enough for the Champions League, as you would know, is good enough for Ligue 1. But yeah, it was so bad, I almost turned it off.
I did. Almost. Right, final destination on this whistle-stop tour of the continent is Spain. We'll talk La Liga next.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Ahí va, Soler, amaga una, amaga dos, toma carrera, chuta, Soler, gol. Gol, 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 gol. Hat-trick de Soler. Marca Soler, marca el Valencia. Valencia 4, Real Madrid 1.
The sounds there of Valencia 4, Real Madrid 1. Alvaro, should we praise Los Murciélagos before we stick the boot into Zizou?
Yes, of course, because, Matt, I think that it was supposed to be a really bad time for Valencia, this one. And the players and the manager have turned the situation around. A week ago, or 8 days ago, Valencia was losing, trailing 2-1 against Getafe. In a league game that was very important for them. Valencia was in a huge crisis. Javi Gracia was really annoyed with the ownership because he never got the players that he was promised he was going to get. And Condogbia was set to depart to Atletico de Madrid. All that 8 days ago. And, you know, that game against Getafe, finally they managed to score a goal, a penalty in the aggregate. Valencia got a point. It was considered like a heroic point for the team. Then Condogbia went to Atletico de Madrid. I think that that calmed the things down a little bit at Valencia's camp because he didn't train for 16 or 17 days and, you know, he wasn't wanted there anymore. And then Real Madrid was, you know, traveling to Valencia to play a football game. And Valencia managed to get a victory against them. So, you know, they got 4 points out of the last six and it's been a good week for them because you can see that despite the losses of Francis Coquelin, Parejo, Rodrigo to Leeds, you know, many referential figures have left Valencia this summer, there are still some guys who are there and they take it seriously. The likes of, for example, Gaya, who is probably the best Spanish fullback at the minute, even better than Sergio Reguilón, or the likes of Carlos Soler, who scored the hat-trick on a penalty. They are all local guys. They believe the club should be in a better position, they want the club to be in a better position, and they feel very identified. So I think that it has been a really gratifying week for Valencia in that respect, because you can see that not only they have players from the academy who take it seriously, but also they have some young guys, like Kang In Lee, for example, the guy from South Korea, or Musa, the guy who lived in Barking, the guy who was born in the United States, who actually, you know, they are great prospects. In fact, Musa has been capped with the United States to play this week, a couple of friendlies. So, you know, little by little, you can see that there are good things as well in Javi Gracia's team. And it looked like that was never going to happen this season.
Not so good for Real Madrid, though. Here's Yusuf asking, thoughts on Zidane and how long it is till he walks away again?
Well, I think that Zidane, you know, if the Titanic sinks, Zinedine Zidane has to be there. Because he has won 3 Champions League with them, and 3 Champions League out of 13 must be like more than the 20% of all the Champions League that Real Madrid has won in history. So they have been won by the same manager. Full tribute, full respect to this manager, all right? He's got the right to get it wrong, but in all fairness, he's getting some things wrong now. For example, I think that his policy of heavy rotations sometimes doesn't work because there are players who must be in the lineup all pretty much always, the likes of Casemiro or Sergio Ramos or Karim Benzema, Thibaut Courtois, some others that, you know, they have had a great past as Real Madrid managers. They don't have a great present, and I wonder if they will have a great future. Like, for example, Isco started against Valencia, and he looks like an ex-player, with all due respect to the guy. But you know,
how does he look like an ex-player in the way he looks? Is he has he put on 12 kilograms and sort of,
well,
you know, looks?
He's got the principle of ponytail, you know, which I don't know, that doesn't look great to start with.
Yeah, I mean, men with long hair, really.
Yeah, long hair is bad.
I mean, that is just midlife crisis written all over, isn't it?
when was the last time that Isco played a good game? I really have to go to 2018 to find a game like that.
Even Isco, longer for me.
And for me too. But Isco or Asensio, they were players that when Real Madrid won the Champions League in 2017, they were fundamental in that Real Madrid team. Asensio, I believe that he scored in that final against Juventus. Isco was probably the best Spanish player 3 years ago. But, you know, they are just not giving the level. And yeah, irrespective of all the things that happened against Valencia, having three penalties against, that Eden Hazard and Casemiro were out due to COVID-19, despite all the little setbacks during the game, Real Madrid was bang average again. They managed to survive against Inter in Champions League, but 3-4 days later, they cannot translate the good vibes from the Champions League into the league. So, you know, I believe that if the league is won, as I said at the beginning of the season, if the league is won by 80 or 85 points, which it looks like, Real Madrid is going to be a contestant and a candidate to win it. But I find it very difficult to believe that in Europe Real Madrid is going to have any chance, especially if you see games like Bayern, Borussia, or Manchester City, Liverpool. In terms of rhythm, in terms of pace, these teams are miles ahead of Real Madrid.
Better news for Barcelona this weekend, though. 5-2 win against Betis on Saturday. Messi started on the bench and finished with his first goal from open play this season, and he got a penalty too.
Yeah, I think that the game left a bitter taste on Barcelona because Ansu Fati had to be replaced in the halftime, and what it looked to be just a little bit of pain in the knee has turned out to be an injury in his meniscus, and on Monday Ansu Fati had to undergo surgery in Barcelona for the meniscus in his left knee, and he's going to be out from 3 to 5 months, which is a blow for Barcelona because Ansu Fati was the most refreshing new of the team this season. But, you know, there was also the chance of having a conservative treatment with Ansu Fati, getting him back on the pitch in a month's time. But that would have been bad in the long run for Ansu Fati's career. It was better to, you know, for him to have surgery. And, you know, even if he misses the rest of the season, which he won't, at the beginning of next season, he's going to be 18 years old. He's got the whole future ahead of him. So, yeah, good luck to him, to Ansu Fati. Then Lionel Messi, yes, as you said, he was on the bench against Betis. And, you know, it was very, very easy to get like easy conclusions from that thing, because there has been a meme, I don't know if you call it like that, like a 3 or 5 seconds clip in Spanish media about Lionel Messi just not pressing a defender from Dynamo Kiev in the last seconds of the game against Dynamo Kiev, and Barcelona was winning the game just by a 1-goal margin. And, you know, he got heavily criticized in social media for that. And then Koeman put him on the bench in the game against Betis. Well, if Messi wouldn't have played well against Betis, I guess that the controversy between Koeman and Messi, or the talks about the bad relationship between Koeman and Messi, would have carried on. But Messi played so well in the second half. He gave an assist without touching the ball, just jumping over the ball to Griezmann to score. And then he scored an open play goal and a penalty, and Barcelona won 5-2. So it was good for him. And only one thing about Barcelona that maybe you don't know, but it's worth being mentioned. You know that there will be elections for Barcelona board very soon. I believe that in January. Well, the main favorite to win the elections is a guy called Victor Font. And one of the guys that is going to work with him if he wins the elections is Tony Nadal, Rafael Nadal's coach until a couple of years ago, which is something that I found quite interesting because, you know, it's quite a switch passing from tennis to football. But yeah, he will be responsible in a department created to raise young academy players from a human point of view. It's a bit random.
Yeah, sounds ace. You know, love that. Hope it's not a racket, etc. and so on. Last game we're going to talk about, Real Sociedad 2-0 against Granada. Sociedad going into the break, top of the Liga, but they're not really the story here, Alvaro, are they? It's Granada and their ravaged squad, which meant they just had 4 first-team players available for this
game. It's unbelievable. I mean, Real Sociedad did the job, considering, but it's the story is on Granada, of course, because Granada, you know, on a Thursday before playing against Omonia in the Europa League, they confirmed 5 positive cases of COVID-19. That to La Liga is an outbreak, and yeah, Granada could play that game in Cyprus. They won in Cyprus, and later in the week, more members of the squad got infected. Even the manager Diego Martinez got the COVID-19. And in the light of the events, Granada requested the suspension of the game against Real Sociedad on Sunday. They requested that twice. La Liga said no, the Spanish FA said no as well. And from that moment, the protocol of La Liga had to be enforced. And according to that protocol, the only players who could play in San Sebastián were those who had a negative PCR test, a positive antibody test, and those who did not travel to Cyprus. Well, basically, fast forward to the weekend, and Granada traveled to San Sebastián with seven professionals in the match day squad. The seven of them started at Reale Arena against Real Sociedad, but then in the halftime, two of those players were replaced, two of those professionals. The minimum needed for a game to take place is five professionals, or first team players. Granada had five after the 45th minute, and then Jorge Molina got an injury, another professional player, and Granada was down to four of them. So yeah, now Granada are facing disciplinary action for a breach of the protocols, and probably Real Sociedad is going to end up winning this game by a better scoreline, 3-0, and Granada is also facing a fine.
Wow, sounds like they did well to keep it down to two in that case. We're nearly done for the day, but let's have a look at a couple of Nations League games before we go. What's caught your eye, Jules? Portugal v France. It was 0-0 in Paris a month ago.
Yeah, I guess that could be the final of the group if you want. They will still have one game to play the following week against Sweden for France and Croatia for Portugal. But you think that the winner of this one, if there is a winner, could qualify. Deschamps, be interesting, I think, so far, because he tried loads of different things. We had a 4-4-2 with a diamond midfield. We had three at the back with like a 3-4-3 and a more flat 3-4-3 than one with a number 10 behind the two strikers as well and three at the back. So he's tried a lot of things. Let's see what he does this time round. It was quite a boring game in the 0-0 draw. They were quite solid, both of them. It might be similar. We've got injury worries with Mbappe, who didn't play at the weekend, or in Leipzig for PSG. Deschamps is hoping he'll be back on Saturday. Same for Kimpembe, same for Pavard, obviously, as we said before, didn't play in the Clásico. So it'd be interesting to see what Deschamps does. But that's there. That's the big one for us.
Rafa, Germany against Ukraine might not be as easy as some might think. Ukraine beat Spain last time out.
It did. I mean, I don't know quite how, because Germany also played Ukraine in that international break. They were quite poor. Can only explain in a way that Spain kind of took the game a little bit too easy and just weren't quite at the races. But yeah, I mean, Germany, it's very difficult. There's a lot of effort being made in making kind of the team more popular at the moment and making people respond to them. Last month, they put them all up in a special edition of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire for charity purposes. Without a crowd, so it felt a little bit flat. Not sure it had the desired effect. The games are a little bit devoid of meaning at the moment, even in the Nation League. Difficult to get hugely excited, and even some of the players I've been told are not that keen on really playing for Germany at the moment. Of course, they understand the importance and they want to represent Germany, but it all feels a little bit like the sort of game you wouldn't mind missing right now in November.
Italy, Poland, James, what sort of shape are Italy in going into this one?
Well, Mancini has got COVID-19. He's asymptomatic, but he will have to test negative before he can take charge of the team in Coverciano. They're training based in Florence, so at the moment his assistant Alberigo Evani is in charge. He named 41 players in his squad, and that has since been shaved to 18 because of the restrictions that we touched upon earlier, which doesn't make his job any easier. In fact, he had to adapt to that on our Sunday night because, yeah, in some respects, you had players dropping out through injury, like AC Milan centre-back Alessio Romagnoli, like Angelo Ogbonna, for example. And then you have this kind of really weird staggered system of you know, the players who have, for example, Sassuolo players who've been in isolation, you know, they may be authorized to come to the training camp on Tuesday. So, you know, they don't have a manager, they don't have a lot of their players, and it's going to be really complicated. I think it begs the question, aside from money, for federations who, you know, went so long without without games and certainly friendlies. You know, why is this happening? You know, the international calendar is so congested, and we're living in kind of this unprecedented environment that, yeah, these games feel quite frivolous, really, and seem to be putting their players under yet more duress in a condensed season. And then, you know, I mean, as I mentioned before, in Italy last October, you had players going away, the most high profile of which was Cristiano Ronaldo, and coming back positive for COVID-19. So it's an interesting, it's a very mixed bag. I mean, in terms of where Italy are in their group, I mean, that win that they got in September in Amsterdam was huge for them. It then kind of was mitigated by the kind of draws that they had in Poland, 0-0, and then the 1-1 with the Netherlands in the return game in Bergamo. So delicately poised, I would say, Matt, delicately poised.
All right, that was a decent sell. As you say, not much of an appetite for this break this year in particular, and probably not much of an appetite for Spain versus Switzerland, Alvaro. Spain not exactly free scoring at the moment.
Absolutely, you're right. And the previous international week was a very disappointing one for Spain. They only scored one goal in three games. And that only goal came after a horrific mistake by Jan Sommer, the goalkeeper of Switzerland, who basically gave the ball to the Spanish striker for him to pass it to another one. And Oyarzabal scored. But, you know, I think that Luis Enrique, the Spanish manager, needs this time. Spain is under a huge transformation. I believe that Luis Enrique wants to make Spanish football look a little bit more modern, more cagey, quicker, and he's trying to do hard. And I wonder if, you know, that transformation that he's trying to trigger is going to come on time for the Euros, because he has been changing the team a lot. For example, in this list that he gave on Friday, there are new players again, the likes of Marcos Llorente, Koke is back after a couple of years, Héctor Bellerín is here because... It's true, Jesus Navas just got an injury, but still, he's shaking the tree too much, and I don't know if this is going to be good in a medium term. So I believe that yeah, the games are important for Spain because Luis Enrique wants to train more. There is a friendly against the Netherlands. I know that it's quite questionable to play friendlies at the minute, but at the same time, the Spanish FA needs that money, because that money that has a repercussion in the Spanish third division. It goes to the players, goes to the clubs as well. And then two Nations League games against Switzerland and Germany. Well, Spain depends on their own results to make it to the finals of the Nations League. They just have to win two games.
And let's finish with a question from Alexei Yavampai, who asks, if players from big countries are absolutely tired after the club season, can Finland or some other small country win the Euros next summer? Alexei is Finnish, as you might have guessed. Raf, we've been talking about it, you know, in leagues across Europe, the title races are going to be more open this season because of the circumstances. I guess it would make sense, therefore, that something similar might apply to the Euros?
Yeah, I don't think it's impossible. I mean, we saw in 2004 Greece winning at a time when the Champions League had only just moved back to a straight knockout. And I think there was still a knock-on effect of players getting injured around the 2002 mark, when there was just too much football in those couple of seasons. So I think it is possible. Of course, the best players, even as some of the smaller nations, would have probably played quite a few games as well. So if they then lose one or two of their best players, I guess the knock-on effect for them is worse than for the big teams who have more depth. So in theory, yes, but I think a lot of things would have to happen for a team of that category to truly actually win it.
What do you think, Jules? Can you see a Minnow causing an upset?
Yeah, I'm all for like a small country like Italy to win it, to be fair. I think they have a chance for once. I mean, if they, you know, if they can qualify. No, I mean, I agree with Raf, though. I think even the smaller First Nation players would play in the big leagues anyway and would have games every 3 days or four. So I don't know how much difference it would make. But it, certainly, I think we leave a very open tournament in this comes the summer. And probably the country will have the less injuries come the summer, or the fresher players, maybe, I think we'll have a big chance to go far.
also teams like France, for example, they've got so many players that they can cap that even if, you know, for example, let's say that Rafael Varane is having a bad season, they've got so many centre-backs that they can resort to, you know? I mean, such a depth that I find it very difficult that a new team wins or gives a massive surprise now, as it happened in 2004 with Greece.
Thing is, James, it just feels like it's light years away rather than essentially a couple of months away, doesn't it? So much can happen between now and next summer in terms of the state of the world as to whether we're actually going to get this, you know, tournament spread across different countries, being played, being completed and having any kind of integrity about it.
Yeah, I think maybe this is an answer to one of the questions that I was posing just a few minutes ago as to why this is happening. I think with the Nations League and the friendlies at the moment, it's to show that international football around the continent is possible ahead of the proposed European Championships next summer. I mean, this is, if I'm not mistaken, the last international break of the year. Yeah, that's why we've been compressing all these internationals into a couple of breaks, and then it goes away again for a long time. And maybe by the time it comes back, the situation will be much improved. With the news yesterday of Pfizer and their vaccine and its 90% success rate. We just have to find a place where it's just cold enough to store these vaccines and then roll them out on a industrial scale. But I think in some respects it will be on us sooner than we think, you know, in the blink of an eye. And again, Michel Platini could not have foreseen, that staging the competition in multiple countries was going to be the problem that it now seems like. But it's going to be very interesting to see if that format holds, or for example, whether we end up doing something a little like what happened in the summer with the Champions League and the Europa League, where we just say, you know what, it's better off if we just base the countries in one nation and get it all done in two or three venues.
Yeah, there you go, Alexi. Finland might win it, but let's just concentrate on actually getting the tournament played, first of all. That'll do us for today. Jimbo will be back with the gang in a fortnight's time. For now, though, my thanks to Jules, to Rafa, to James, to Alvaro, to producer Charlie, and to you, listener, of course. It's bye for now. We'll catch up again soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on The Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.